Then he saw the boy who had been Hank Reardon at 18. He saw the tension of the face, the speed of the walk, the drunken exhilaration of the body, drunk on the energy of sleepless nights, the proud lift of the head, the clear, steady, ruthless eyes, the eyes of a man who drove himself without pity toward that which he wanted. And he saw what Paul Larkin must have been at that time, a youth with an aged baby's face, smiling ingratiatingly, joylessly, begging to be spared, pleading with the universe to give him a chance. If someone had shown that youth to the Hank Reardon of that time and told him that this was to be the goal of his steps, the collector of the energy of his aching tendons, what would he have? It was not a thought. It was like the punch of a fist inside his skull. Then, when he could think again, Reardon knew what the boy he had been would have felt, a desire to step on the obscene thing which was Larkin and grind every wet bit of it out of existence. He had never experienced an emotion of this kind. It took him a few moments to realize that this was what men called hatred. He noticed that, rising to leave and muttering some sort of goodbye, Larkin had a wounded, reproachful, mouth-pinched look, as if he, Larkin, were the injured party. When he sold his coal mines to Ken Daniker, who owned the largest coal company in Pennsylvania, Reardon wondered why he felt as if it were almost painless. He felt no hatred. Ken Daniker was a man in his 50s with a hard, closed face. He had started in life as a miner. When Reardon handed to him the deed to his new property, Daniker said impassively, "I don't believe I've mentioned that any coal you buy from me, you'll get it at cost." Reardon glanced at him, astonished. "It's against the law," he said. "Who's going to find out what sort of cash I hand to you in your own living room?" "You're talking about a rebate." "I am. That's against 24 laws. They'll sock you worse than me if they catch you at it." "Sure, that's your protection. So you won't be left at the mercy of my goodwill." Reardon smiled. It was a happy smile, but he closed his eyes as under a blow. Then he shook his head. "Thanks," he said. "But I'm not one of them. I don't expect anybody to work for me at cost." "I'm not one of them either," said Daniker angrily. "Look here, Reardon, don't you suppose I know what I'm getting? Unearned. The money doesn't pay you for it. Not nowadays. You didn't volunteer to bid to buy my property. I asked you to buy it. I wish there had been somebody like you in the ore business to take over my mines. There wasn't. If you want to do me a favor, don't offer me rebates. Give me a chance to pay you higher prices, higher than anyone else will offer. Sock me anything you wish, just so I'll be the first to get the coal. I'll manage my end of it. Only let me have the coal." "You'll have it." Reardon wondered for a while why he heard no word from Wesley Mooch. His calls to Washington remained unanswered. Then he received a letter consisting of a single sentence which informed him that Mr. Mooch was resigning from his employ. 2 weeks later, he read in the newspapers that Wesley Mooch had been appointed assistant coordinator of the Bureau of Economic Planning and National Resources. Don't dwell on any of it, thought Reardon, through the silence of many evenings, fighting the sudden access of that new emotion which he did not want to feel. There is an unspeakable evil in the world, you know it, and it's no use dwelling on the details of it. You must work a little harder, just a little harder. Don't let it win. The beams and girders of the Reardon Metal Bridge were coming daily out of the rolling mills and were being shipped to the site of the John Galt Line, where the first shapes of green-blue metal, swung into space to span the canyon, glittered in the first rays of the spring sun. He had no time for pain, no energy for anger. Within a few weeks it was over. The blinding stabs of hatred ceased and did not return. He was back in confident self-control on the evening when he telephoned Eddie Willers. "Eddie, I'm in New York at the Wayne Falkland. Come to have breakfast with me tomorrow morning. There's something I'd like to discuss with you." Eddie Willers went to the appointment with a heavy feeling of guilt. He had not recovered from the shock of the Equalization of Opportunity bill. It had left a dull ache within him like the black and blue mark of a blow. He disliked the sight of the city. It now looked as if it hid the threat of some malicious unknown. He dreaded facing one of the bill's victims. He felt almost as if he, Eddie Willers, shared the responsibility for it in some terrible way which he could not define. When he saw Reardon, the feeling vanished. There was no hint suggesting a victim in Reardon's bearing. Beyond the windows of the hotel room, the spring sunlight of early morning sparkled on the windows of the city. The sky was a very pale blue that seemed young. The offices were still closed, and the city did not look as if it held malice, but as if it were joyously, hopefully ready to swing into action, in the same manner as Reardon. He looked refreshed by an untroubled sleep. He wore a dressing gown. He seemed impatient of the necessity to dress, unwilling to delay the exciting game of his business duties. "Good morning, Eddie. Sorry if I got you out so early. It's the only time I had. I have to go back to Philadelphia right after breakfast. We can talk while we're eating." The dressing gown he wore was of dark blue flannel, with the white initials HR on the breast pocket. He looked young, relaxed, at home in this room and in the world. Eddie watched a waiter wheel the breakfast table into the room with a swift efficiency that made him feel braced. He found himself enjoying the stiff freshness of the white tablecloth and the sunlight sparkling on the silver, on the two bowls of crushed ice holding glasses of orange juice. He had not known that such things could give him an invigorating pleasure. "I didn't want to phone Dagny long distance about this particular matter," said Reardon. "She has enough to do. We can settle it in a few minutes, you and I. If I have the authority to do it." Reardon smiled. "You have." He leaned forward across the table. "Eddie, what's the financial state of Taggart Transcontinental at the moment?"
"Desperate."
"Worse than that, Mr. Reardon."
"Are you able to meet payrolls?"
"Not quite. We've kept it out of the newspapers, but I think everybody knows it. We're in arrears all over the system, and Jim is running out of excuses."
"Do you know that your first payment for the Reardon Metal Rail is due next week?"
"Yes, I know it."
"Well, let's agree on a moratorium. I'm going to give you an extension. You won't have to pay me anything until 6 months after the opening of the John Galt line."
Eddie Willers put down his cup of coffee with a sharp thud. He could not say a word.
Reardon chuckled. "What's the matter? You do have the authority to accept, don't you?"
"Mr. Reardon, I don't know what to say to you."
"Why, just okay is all that's necessary."
"Okay, Mr. Reardon." Eddie's voice was barely audible.
"I'll draw up the papers and send them to you. You can tell Jim about it and have him sign them."
"Yes, Mr. Reardon."
"I don't like to deal with Jim. He'd waste 2 hours trying to make himself believe that he's made me believe that he's doing me a favor by accepting."
Eddie sat without moving, looking down at his plate.
"What's the matter?"
"Mr. Reardon, I'd like to say thank you. But there isn't any form of it big enough to..."
"Look, Eddie, you've got the makings of a good businessman, so you'd better get a few things straight. There aren't any thank yous in situations of this kind. I'm not doing it for Taggart Transcontinental. It's a simple, practical, selfish matter on my part. Why should I collect my money from you now when it might prove to be the death blow to your company? If your company were no good, I'd collect and fast. I don't engage in charity, and I don't gamble on incompetence. But you're still the best railroad in the country. When the John Galt line is completed, you'll be the soundest one financially. So I have good reason to wait. Besides, you're in trouble on account of my rail. I intend to see you win."
"I still owe you thanks, Mr. Reardon, for something much greater than charity."
"No. Don't you see? I have just received a great deal of money, which I didn't want. I can't invest it. It's of no use to me whatever. So in a way it pleases me that I can turn that money against the same people in the same battle. They made it possible for me to give you an extension to help you fight them."
He saw Eddie wincing, as if he had hit a wound. "That's what's horrible about it."
"What?"
"What they've done to you, and what you're doing in return. I mean..."
He stopped.
"Forgive me, Mr. Reardon. I know this is no way to talk business."
Reardon smiled. Thanks, Eddie, I know what you mean. But forget it. To hell with them.
Yes. Only, Mr. Reardon, may I say something to you? I know it's completely improper, and I'm not speaking as a vice president.
Go ahead.
I don't have to tell you what your offer means to Dagny, to me, to every decent person on Taggart Transcontinental. You know it, and you know you can count on us. But I think it's horrible that Jim Taggart should benefit, too. That you should be the one to save him and people like him. After they...
Reardon laughed. Eddie, what do we care about people like him? We're driving an express and they're riding on the roof, making a lot of noise about being leaders. Why should we care? We have enough power to carry them along, haven't we?